The following program is pre-recorded. Welcome to the Jerry Pepin UFO Show. Once again, we're talking about Aztec, New Mexico. In late March of 1948, was there a UFO crash there? Researcher Dennis Malthaser and his thoughts about Aztec.
Quite honestly, Jerry, when I bought the book UFO Crash at Aztec, which Wendell Stevens co-authored years ago, and to be honest with you, at the time I didn't put much confidence in the crash. It happened in March of 1948, about a year, well, 6 or 8 months after the Roswell incident, and I didn't put a whole lot of confidence in it at the time. But the more research that is done by Stanton Friedman, by Linda Moulton Howe, and Scott Ramsey, and Scott has done a tremendous amount of research on this, the more information that comes forward, the more I'm believing there something really did happen there. And if you go to the crash site, and they had tours to the crash site where people could go out there, there is an area out there that looks like it was changed somehow by something coming in, and it looks almost like it was a soft landing. It wasn't a crash where it destroyed the thing. But the thing that's most interesting to me is there's a concrete slab out there that's probably 4 by 4 feet in dimension and about 8 or 10 inches thick, and it is loaded with reinforcing steel to give it strength. And so far, Scott has taken a core sample of that concrete, and it does date back to about 1948. Now, having a concrete slab out there in that canyon could be several things. It could be a well cap, or it could have something to do with the gas that's drilled out there, but nobody with any of the gas companies has ever verified that it had anything to do with that. So what we believe is that it may have been a slab that was poured, roughly poured with a quick form put up and concrete poured with reinforcing steel, and may have been a pad to put a crane on for the outriggers on the crane because of the terrain there and the soft dirt, that it may have been a pad to put a crane on to lift the craft out. And to me, that is something extremely important, and they're going to do some more testing on the concrete and see if they can get any fine-tuning on it as to when it was put there.
It's one of the better researchers around, Dennis Balthaser, Elizabeth Roswell. And we contacted Scott Ramsey about those tests on that cement block there at Hart Canyon in Aztec to find out a little bit more. If you remember, last week we had Mark McClandish on, and he went up there and checked out the entire scene and went into vivid descriptions about it and the whole bit about the Aztec landing, what the landing site looked like, et cetera, et cetera. If you haven't heard that show, it's available in its entirety at iPodShows.net. And also, by the way, we will have Mark McClandish on here in a minute, and he's going to talk to us about his trip up to Dulce, to the Archuleta Mesa. And he was there in the middle of the night, intended to spend the night, but it turned out to be quite a scary affair. I think you'll find that enjoyable. That'll be coming up in a minute. But first of all, let me read you what Scott Ramsey wrote me. He says, yes, we have done some rather extensive tests on the slab in order to pinpoint the exact date within 6 months. However, to do this, we need about $25,000. Tests have shown that it was no older nor no newer than 1948. And we came to this conclusion with some of the rebar and the examination of it. The concrete slab needs to be removed for future study, as souvenir hunters are there chipping away at it almost daily. Hope this helps. Your friend Scott Ramsey. Now, in a little bit, we're going to deal with remote viewing in our show, but we have some other things to do first. And the reason we are going to deal with remote viewing is something is happening at Aztec at the symposium, the 14th annual one this weekend. They're in Aztec, New Mexico, up in the Four Corners area of New Mexico and Colorado. Lynn Buchanan, who is recognized as one of the leaders in remote viewing, assembled 11 remote viewers from around the world, from Europe and other places, as well as the United States, and he tasked them to find out a little bit about Aztec. Now, we'll go into detail with Lynn before the program is over about how he did this. We'll also talk to Janet Saylor, our correspondent, who is there in Aztec, and she will she'll tell us a little bit about what Lynn did in his presentation last year. And he'll be back this year, and he'll be talking more about what the remote viewers found out about the Aztec crash. And I think you'll find it all very interesting. I can't urge you enough, if you're up in that area or you have an ability to get to Aztec, New Mexico this weekend, I would recommend it, because this this conference, this symposium is dynamite. And it's only $25. And actually, there's senior citizens discounts. Go over to the Aztec website. It's called AztecUFO.com, and check it out. Our good friend Norio Hayakawa also is there on Friday night, and he'll be playing music and also talking to people about his UFO research. And he specializes in Dulce. And we've got something very interesting about Dulce coming up here in a moment with Mark McClendish, so don't go away. Anyway, you need to stay tuned tonight. We have an incredible show. Some of the other interesting things that will be happening up here at Aztec is Marshall Klanfeld is a researcher on ancient UFOs and aliens, and he says he can prove extraterrestrials created man in their own image. And this groundbreaking new research is in a new book that he has out called Adam, The Missing Link. And I think, that's a subject everyone's interested in. Chuck Waite will be there, too, researcher, who has done research on several UFO crashes. I think Chuck says there's 7 UFO crashes in New Mexico all total from 1945 through 1948. And he has a reason, and he'll be explaining that at his conference, in his presentation there at Aztec, on why these crashes happened. And it involves the radar we were using at the time, and we were actually using it as a weapon. And he's done several retrievals, including artifacts from the St. Augustine Plains area of New Mexico, and he has some amazing reports from a lab on these pieces of a flying saucer that he found. Stephen Jones from the UK is an experiencer. He's been around really an unbelievable 50 years of ET experiences and contact. And his presentation will keep you on the edge of your chair as well. Dr. Robert Farrell, a researcher, engineer, and author, will be there as well. And he'll be talking about the science behind alien encounters. And, of course, Lynn Buchanan. But right now, I think we want to go to Mark McClendish. And this is part two of an interview that we played part one last week. And last week, we concentrated on the Aztec landing and his impressions there. But this week we're going to feature Mark in a harrowing story about going up to the Ocholeta Mesa in Dulce, New Mexico, and near the, that's where the underground base is supposed to be for ETs. And we've done a lot of shows on that, and most people know about it. And Mark thought he'd go up there and spend the night. And he arrived at 1:30 in the morning, and he left about 3:30. And you'll find out why. So let's play that interview now. And if you'd like to hear the entire show, it's available at iPodShows.net. Let's go ahead and roll this tape.
We were talking with Mark McCandlish, and Mark, you know, you've had quite a career in aerospace, doing project drawings and paintings, et cetera, et cetera. If you had a chance to draw, or you had an assignment to draw a picture of the craft at Aztec, what do you think it would look like?
Well, this was a classic flying saucer. In fact, the closest thing that I've seen that would resemble the appearance of this craft in terms of its general proportions, its coloration, the contours of the saucer-shaped portion of the craft. If you were to, you could probably find this on the internet, on YouTube or one of those sites that goes back and reviews old movies. But the flying saucer that these astronauts use in the film Forbidden Planet, which I believe was produced by the Disney Studios, it had almost exactly the same proportions in almost every respect as the saucer that was described and portrayed, you know, probably through model work in that film. In fact, that was one of the things that was so surprising about that film was that, and I believe it was produced the year I was born, in 1953, starring Leslie Nielsen, who passed away recently.
Mm-hmm.
Even the access ramp that is described in Forbidden Planet on this vehicle was structured in exactly the same way as the one that the scientists found during the recovery of the Aztec crash. So you have to ask yourself if there weren't people who, even back then in the film industry, were being prepared for what a lot of us believe is a kind of acclimation of, you know, the Earth's population to the possibility that, yes, indeed, we're being visited by entities from other star systems. And that's certainly, I mean, there's just so many, the proportions of the craft, the color, the access ramp, maybe even some of the internal controls, I'd have to go back and check, but it's just so coincidental, it doesn't seem to me as though...
Art imitates life or life imitates art? I'm not sure. Anyway, it seems like we're being prepared for, you know, final disclosure announcements, and then nothing ever happens.
Well, you know, I think I've told you that in the course of my research into this whole area that I've encountered some really unusual things.
I understand you used to listen to late night radio and UFO shows. And it wasn't Art Bell, it was Billy Goodman.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, he had the program, I think it was called the Billy Goodman Happening.
Mark, I know Billy Goodman very well. He used to follow me on the air at KVEG in Las Vegas, AM 840.
Is that right?
I was on from 10 to midnight, and he was midnight on. I did an occasional UFO show, but basically I was an entertainment and mass appeal general subjects host. But Billy, he had quite a successful format
there. Wow. Well, whatever happened to Billy? Is he still around?
Passed away.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Had cancer.
Oh,
lived in Providence, Rhode Island, I believe. Oh. Yeah, we'll miss him. He was quite a talent. Yeah, Gloria Euphoria, who used to help him, she's in contact with me. She still lives in Southern California. Ted Rice, the producer of that show at one time. Ted still lives in Las Vegas. Cosmos on YouTube. Check him out. You didn't go up to Area 51 with him, up to Groom Lake, did you? I mean, he chartered a bus, took a lot of people up there.
Well, not with Billy Goodman, but I did go up there on my own.
Yeah, Norio Hayakawa went up there with Billy Goodman one time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that. I know that Sean David Morton, who I also know, had gone up there several times and caught the attention of the security people there from Wackenhut. And in fact, I found, unfortunately, that there's a very clear and obvious relationship between the county sheriff's office that kind of patrols the highways in that area and the security personnel for Area 51, because one of the other little trips that I made in my Fiero was up to where the mailbox is on that road that kind of leads down
mm-hmm.
to the northern gate for that complex.
Yeah, the mailboxes to nowhere.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, in fact, I I didn't see any signs that said you can't go beyond this point, so I drove right down to the point where it says, you know, you can't go beyond this point, and the use of deadly force is authorized. So I, you know, got out and took some pictures of the terrain and just sort of in a souvenir kind of sense, and got back into my car, got back on the highway, and I got stopped 3 times by the county sheriff and written tickets every single time for going over the speed limit when I wasn't going over the speed limit. And the clear message there was, we don't like you poking the boundaries of our area over here. So there's not much you can do about something like that, and especially when you live hundreds of miles away. It's not like you can drive over there 3 times to make an appearance, mm-hmm. and make a pleading and then come back later and fight in court and all that kind of stuff. It's just too expensive. So you pay the bill. And that was the penalty I paid for poking around that area. But
did you find anything else while
you were
there?
I actually went there because there was a young fellow that worked at the bank that I was using at that time, who said that he'd heard these stories on the radio also, and he and some of his friends had decided to go out there and, you know, have a case of beer and kick back and, you know, sort of wait to see if they could see a UFO. And he said that they got a little bit too tipsy, and they decided they'd take off across the desert and see how close they could get to the boundary of the area before somebody came up and gave them what for. This kid said that as they were getting close to one of the boundaries, and there's not much you can do about something like that, and especially when you live hundreds of miles away, it's not like you can drive over there 3 times to make an appearance, mm-hmm. and make a pleading and then come back later and fight in court and all that kind of stuff. It's just too expensive, so you pay the bill. And that was the penalty I paid for poking around that area.
Did you find anything else while you were there?
Well, I actually went there because there was a young fellow that worked at the bank that I was using at that time, who said that he'd heard these stories on the radio also, and he and some of his friends had decided to go out there and, you know, have a case of beer and kick back and, you know, sort of wait to see if they could see a UFO. And he said that they got a little bit too tipsy, and they decided they'd take off across the desert and see how close they could get to the boundary of the area before somebody came up and gave them what for. And he said that they encountered a brilliant, this brilliant ball of light approached their vehicle at a high rate of speed, stopped, hovered not too far from their location, and, you know, they all jumped out of the car and they were looking at this thing and, you know, somewhat afraid and mystified by what they were seeing, and then right as they were watching this thing, it turned transparent and disappeared.
Wow.
And to hear this young man tell a story, I mean, you could see, you know, his eyelids kind of flutter and his hands start to shake, because he'd obviously experienced something that really left an impression on him. And that was, you know, in addition to all the other stories that I'd heard about that area, it was something that motivated me to go out there and look at that. This brilliant ball of light approached their vehicle at a high rate of speed, stopped, hovered not too far from their location, and, you know, they all jumped out of the car and they were looking at this thing and, you know, somewhat afraid and mystified by what they were seeing, and then right as they were watching this thing, it turned transparent and disappeared.
Wow.
And to hear this young man tell a story, I mean, you could see, you know, his eyelids kind of flutter and his hands start to shake, because he'd obviously experienced something that really left an impression on him. And that was, you know, in addition to all the other stories that I'd heard about that area, it was something that motivated me to go out there and
anything and like that happened to you while you were around Area 51?
Not while I was there. I actually had more high strangeness after leaving the Aztec area and heading over towards Dulce.
Yeah, I want to get to Dulce, because here on our page we have a picture by a cell phone from a person who lives there, who has a picture of, it's a flying saucer right by the mesa, right by the Archelona Mesa.
You're kidding?
No.
That's amazing.
I'm not kidding. So let's talk about your trip to Dulce. I think you made it up to the top of the mesa.
Well, I traveled across the northern half of New Mexico after leaving Aztec, which is it's not too far from a geographical landmark called Shiprock. It's Aztec is sort of northeast of that location. And so I proceeded east from Aztec towards the highways that would take me into an area of the, I think it's called the Jicarilla Indian Reservation,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of a, it's a reservation. It's probably, I don't know, several hundred square miles, kind of in a long a rectangle that sort of runs north and south, but comes to within, you know, just a few miles of the town of Dulce itself. And so I had to catch a road that approached that area from the south and came up into the Dulce area. I had a friend, a fellow, a UFO researcher who was the fellow that I initially contacted after I came into this information about the alien reproduction vehicle that we've talked about before.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Paul Shepard, and he's since kind of left the whole UFO research field, but he was friends with the son of Dennis Weaver, the actor who used to play McCloud on TV.
Yeah, I know Dennis.
And Dennis Weaver had some property just over the border in Colorado, just north of where the Archuleta Mesa and Dulce is located. And he and his son, I believe his son's name was Rusty, had an awful lot of UFO sightings from what Paul Shepard had told me. And, in fact, Paul Shepard was pretty good friends with Rusty. So, anyway, I had done a little research in the Los Angeles office of the U.S. Geological Survey, which had topographical maps of just about every part of the United States, with the exception of Area 51. That was the one area I couldn't find any maps for. But they did have plenty of maps for the area down around Dulce, and Paul and a number of his friends had decided to mount an expedition to go down there and see whether there was anything to the story of the Archuleta Mesa and, you know, the things that were alleged to have happened in or around Dulce or beneath the mesa in some kind of an underground complex. Several of the people that Paul took with him were some researchers who had one fellow had developed a very sophisticated system, very similar to ground-penetrating radar, but it would use basically high-volume multi-frequency sound broadcasts using large speakers, like the kind you would see being used on stage at some of these rock concerts.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a number of power systems that were sort of independently driven. They could take and put a speaker on a kind of a platform and lay it on the ground, and they'd have a remote control device that would allow them to time the moment of broadcast and the frequencies that were transmitted through these speakers, which of course were pointed down towards the ground. And they would go to four different, you know, specific locations, and then they would sit right in the middle of these the placement of these four speakers. And they would broadcast these various speakers, these frequencies into the ground, and it was all being listened to by a device that they sort of embedded into the ground right in the center of where those speakers were located. And so by sending these different frequencies into the ground rather than using like a, you know, shotgun shell or some kind of a small explosive charge to send out a pulse of sound through the geography of the,
mm-hmm.
of the ground, they would use sound of different frequencies. And it was almost like using an ultrasound to image a child in the womb of a pregnant individual. And so they were able to get a very clear picture of what was happening beneath the Archuleta Mesa. They had these speakers that were positioned at some fairly wide distances from one another. And they came back with data that suggested very strongly that there was a complex beneath the Archuleta Mesa that rivaled the size of New York City. They said that it was just an absolutely massive facility. There was no doubt about it. They could see very clear artificial structures beneath the mesa, and that the electrical systems alone, which I guess because of all the conduit and the copper wire and so forth that went from one area to another for transmission of power and telemetry and things like that, was something you would expect to see used in a city in terms of its size. Now, the only explanation I have for their being able to see these particular components is because of the perhaps the electrical resonance of these systems, probably alternating current. They had all this data. They had a Japanese television station that was coming over to review their data. They wanted to do a special program about all of this. You know, the Japanese are very intrigued by this kind of thing. And right before they were supposed to meet with the Japanese, the individual who had this equipment had since gone back to, I guess it was Phoenix or Tempe, Arizona, where he lived. His home was broken into. All of the data, all of his equipment, everything, you know, like almost $500,000 worth of equipment was stolen. And so they had absolutely no record of what they'd actually seen with their own eyes in terms of the data they collected. So, you know, somebody was obviously very, worried about that information getting out. Now, this was all sort of sitting in the back of my mind as I'm, you know, in my little fear.
When did they do this?
That would have been around 1989, I believe it was.
Okay.
1989 or early 1990. And so around 1991, when I decided that I had to take this Pantera transaxle back east for this rebuild, I decided that I would, travel through these areas and see if I couldn't see, kind of a risky proposition to be going on these, poorly maintained dirt roads through the mountains of New Mexico in a low-slung Fiero.
Yeah.
Ground clearance was a bit of an issue, but I managed to get up on top of the Archuleta.
Oh, you actually made it up there, huh?
Yeah. There's a number of roads that I found on some of the Forestry Service maps. It's at the extreme west end of the town of Dulce, which the main part of the town is just one little street with a few stores on it. It's really not a very exciting town by any means. The thing that was so peculiar about Dulce was that it looks like this little hick town out in the middle of nowhere, except that it's got a multi-million-dollar Best Western five-star rated hotel just north of the town, up on a hillside, just below where the Archuleta Mesa is. Now, there's only one reason I can think of that they'd have a hotel like that in that location, and that is because either there's something in the area that's drawing in tourists. You know, hunting and fishing is certainly one possibility, but the other possibility, of course, is that you have some high-ranking military dignitaries who are coming to visit a complex under Dulce. You know, they may not want to be underground for 5 weeks, you know. They may not want to be down there under the ground with God knows what's happening down there. They might want, you know, some nicer accommodations above ground. And so that was, you know, kind of my thinking.
Boy, would I love to see those motel records. I mean, who checked in, whose charge cards were used.
Oh, yeah, you know, I thought the exact same thing. That's pretty perceptive on your part because, you know, I had thought, about that exact same thing. And so part of the reason that Paul Shepard and his crew were heading down to Dulce was sort of a multi-purpose trip. One of the other things they were doing was they wanted to head down to Albuquerque to a research facility that was operating down there right outside Kirkland Air Force Base.
I bet you're talking about Sandia Base.
Is that right?
You know, I was almost stationed there in the Army. Last minute they sent me to the Bay Area in San Francisco. Probably a good thing. I might not be alive today. I mean, I'm pretty inquisitive. And,
well, you know, they do an awful lot of dangerous research there, a lot of advanced high-energy weapons.
I don't
weapons.
Think the researchers would have hurt me, but maybe my own troops.
Well, anyway, one of the alternate purposes for going down there was to meet with Paul Benowitz, who at the time was claiming that he had had a number of encounters throughout the area and also up near the Archuleta Mesa. So apparently Paul Benowitz had traveled up to the Dulce area, and he'd had a four-wheel drive vehicle, and he traveled a certain distance back into the wilderness, somewhere around the Archuleta Mesa, and he'd come up to a rise that overlooked a kind of a canyon, and that, according to Paul Shepard, he had witnessed the landing of a craft, your stereotypical saucer-shaped craft, which was met by a number of U.S. military vehicles, and there appeared to be, you know, sort of an open, sort of an operation between some entities that appeared to be non-human and human beings, and they were basically loading some kind of cargo into this craft. He took a number of pictures of this thing, and that he jumped, ran back to his truck, jumped in the truck, ran down into the town of Dulce, went to the local drugstore, and excitedly went to the counter and said, "Do you have 1 hour photo processing?" And the fellow said, "Well, yes, we do." And so he excitedly told this guy behind the counter, "I just saw this UFO, you know, meeting some U.S. military trucks, and they were loading cargo into the UFO." And as he's telling this man behind the counter what he had seen and what he'd photographed, the guy just goes pale as a ghost. And without really turning around, he kind of holds his hand in front of him. He points behind him over his shoulder in a way that would prevent anything that was behind him from actually seeing this. And Paul Benowitz looks up, and there's a camera up on the wall. And the man points to the camera without actually pointing over his shoulder and kind of motions with his eyes like, you know, you're being watched. And he tells him, you know, in a very quiet voice, "You need to get out of here right now as fast as you can." And so, you know, Paul took the hint, you know, took the film, ran out to his vehicle, which was kind of a, I guess it was like a four-wheel drive mobile home kind of thing, like a, you know, like a camper shell on the back of a pickup truck or something. So he takes off, and as he's, you know, maybe 200 yards down the road, he sees a number of vehicles with Air Force, the deep Air Force blue with the yellow Air Force, you know, official Air Force vehicle stencil on the side, come screeching to a halt. These guys jump out of the car and go running into the store, and so he knows immediately that he's in trouble. As he's just about out of sight, he sees these guys come running back out to the vehicles, and they immediately begin following him. So now he's out in the middle of the wilderness on this road that that travels south from Dulce, going towards, I guess, the central part of the state, back to the main highway system. And he's out in the middle of nowhere, and he's really afraid that something awful is going to happen to him. So he decides to sort of take matters into his own hands. He comes around a corner and turns his vehicle so that it basically blocks the highway, jumps out of his vehicle, and he had a 357 Magnum pistol, probably a Smith & Wesson. And he basically stood behind his vehicle, and he had this pistol drawn and ready to go as these Air Force vehicles came around the corner. And they all stopped, looked at him for a while, talked among themselves, and they basically just turned around and left. So at that point, he felt that, you know, he had some degree of safety, but it wasn't too long after that, after he got back to his office, that the same thing happened to him, that his camera was stolen and he never saw the film again.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's obvious that, you know, something kind of strange is going on there.
Now, what did you see when you got up there?
Well, that was it. That was the thing that was so strange about it, is that when I got there, by the time I arrived in Dulce, this is after spending part of my afternoon near Aztec looking at what I thought was the crash site of this March 25th, 1948 crash. By the time I got to Dulce, it was nightfall. And so I had a map of the town. I knew where Paul Shepard and some of his crew had gone to get up on top of the Archuleta Mesa. And it was a little dirt road that sort of proceeded north, crossed over a rickety wooden bridge, across a stream that runs a little bit to the west and to the north of Dulce, and started up this mountain road. And I got up onto the top of the mesa, There's a little bit of snow on the ground. It's extremely cold out. I had a sleeping bag, and I really couldn't see any evidence that there was any kind of a military operation going on there. Now, remember, this is like February or March, so it's still pretty much wintertime.
Yeah.
Very, very cold up there. And so the likelihood of you encountering any kind of bugs, any kind of flying insects, is near zero, especially at, 1 o'clock in the morning. So I found a clearing, and I pulled the Fiero off the road. Got my long johns on, put my sleeping bag out on the ground with sort of an insulator pad to kind of keep me warm. And I'm laying there on the ground. I can't see anything, but there is something flying all around me. There's at least three objects, and I don't know what they are, but all I can tell you is that if you've ever had a mosquito kind of fly up and land near your ear, that really high-pitched buzzing sound that you hear, that's the sound that I'm hearing hovering and moving all around me while I'm laying there on the ground. It was the spookiest thing you can imagine because I could not see a thing. Perfectly clear night, moonless night, beautiful star. I mean, more stars than you can imagine because there's no light pollution or anything from Dulce. And yet, I even took a swat, at the open air around me when I thought one of these things came close to me. And I just caught air, nothing else. But I had the distinct feeling that there was some kind of several objects that were hovering around me. And it was really kind of an unnerving experience. And when I would get into the car and roll up the windows, you wouldn't hear it. So it was obviously something in the environment, something that was unseen. But at the same time, it was, something that was obviously paying attention to my presence there. And at one point, a large truck went rumbling by on the roadway. I couldn't really determine whether it was, a civilian truck with, some of the local rednecks out, poking around in the middle of the night, or whether it was a military vehicle. It was just simply too dark. But, I was there for probably 2 hours, and it became more than I can really tolerate.
So you had to get up and get out of it.
Yeah. In fact, I thought about just sitting in the car and watching the sky, but it was just so bone-chilling cold that I basically jumped in the car and I left Dulce.
Okay, Mark, I appreciate you taking time to talk to me today about all of this. Incredible stories. In finishing this, let's wrap it up by, first of all, Aztec. You went to the crash site. You think something probably happened there, right?
It certainly looked like there had been some activity there. Like I say, this large block of cement that looked as though it had either been used to cover something up or been used as a foundation for some kind of a crane or some kind of a physical support for moving components during the disassembly of this craft and the transport, on back roads up to military installation to be transported off to Wright-Patterson. Yeah, so it looked like something had happened there quite a long time ago.
And poking around Area 51, the only thing that was bad that happened to you is you got some speeding ticket.
Yes.
And on top of Enchilada Mesa, in Dulce, you had these strange insect noises, even though it was freezing cold. And you got the hell out of there.
It's, like 25 degrees, and it's middle of the night. Way too cold. I mean, insects, anything below about 45 degrees, and they just almost go completely dormant. They don't fly. They just sit there. And but there was obviously something moving above ground in the air around me, something I could not see, but I could clearly hear it. I mean, and it wasn't just sort of a generalized buzzing sound in the area that was inexplicable. It was actually like there was a point source from the sound. You could actually hear that it was a unique point of emanation for the sound moving around me. Obviously not close enough for me to actually reach out and touch, but loud enough that I could hear it. And it was just an extremely high frequency like the sound of mosquito wings when something's, you know, something like that's coming up to land.
Cold night like that. Did you look around for some vents?
Vents?
Yeah, I mean warm air coming out from the ground. I've always heard reports of vents up there.
No, in fact, I did look for things like that, and I didn't see anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
Not a thing.
Mark McCandlish, it was a great show. Thanks for being on. We'll do it again.
Okay, Jerry.
Appreciate it.
I'm Jerry Pippin. Our web producer is Jane Swartley. Until next time, thank you for listening. Cheers. I want to talk to you about the Aztec Symposium. It takes place in Aztec, New Mexico. It'll be the 14th annual one, by the way. And it's put on by the Friends of the Library. It's a good benefit. And the interesting thing about this is it's not expensive. You can go all day on Saturday, March 26th, for only $25. And there's senior citizens discounts. And if you're a first responder or a military person, you get in free. And now they have a Friday night get-together as well and a fine, fine meal. And that's only $15. And there's a senior citizens discount there as well. Go to the website and check it all out and register. It's AztecUFO.com. AztecUFO.com. You'll find the speaker lineup and all the details. That's AztecUFO.com. That's AztecUFO.com. Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and on this program, we are going to be dealing with the Aztec UFO crash of 1948. In 1947 and 1948, in New Mexico, there were several incidents that shook the foundation of what men at that time believed. All of a sudden, there seemed to be evidence of life in other places, other planets far, far away. There were at least four crashes of UFOs. One of them occurred at a place called Aztec, New Mexico, in this unlikely spot of scenic wilderness. Belief that the human race was superior to everything else was shaken to the core. This is a follow-up program, the Aztec Symposium, held every year in Aztec. The 13th anniversary was something else. Lim Buchanan, a noted and respected remote viewer, along with a cadre of others, actually focused in on the crash of 1948, and his results were astounding. First of all, let's talk to Janet Saylor, our special correspondent, who was there when Lynn made the presentation. Janet, welcome back to the program. And he had 11 remote viewers altogether. I wonder how experienced these remote viewers really are.
But of the people who worked with him, he said they had between 1 and 13 years experience. And there was only one person who had one year of experience, and everybody else actually had between like 8 and 13 years of experience. And that overall, as a group, this group of people had a dependability rating of 68 to 89%, which he felt was pretty high. He says each viewer comes to the task from their own vantage point. You know, that's why you have a group of say, 8 to 10 to 11 or 12 viewers all kind of tasking on the same project. Because it's kind of like the facets of a diamond. You know, depending upon which direction you're coming at it from, it could look a little bit different. And so they get a whole lot more information that way from people, and they can piece it together and make it work a whole lot better for them. So he explained all of that first, and he said that in this particular program, they never actually asked, was there a crash? And so, but they never in any way put that into any of their questions or gave them any hint at all. And he said that there's really, he sort of apologized. He said that he didn't feel, in retrospect, he didn't feel that they had really asked the questions as well as they could have, and but he was very happy with the responses that they got. And he would, you know, he says more detailed tasking is needed on these things because they got so many really good responses. And they can now parse them out and get more and more and more detailed information, including things as detailed as like the size of the saucer that this one person saw. He said, keep sending people in with new tasking instructions, and at some point we can end up with it, you know, to the square millimeter, how big that thing was. And I thought it was pretty, really, very, very fascinating. And, oh, and here's some more interesting things. We know, do you remember when we talked about people seeing the woman? Yeah, they each saw a woman, and they described her very similarly in each case, and they saw dogs, or they saw the animals. Well, according to Lynn, it is typical for remote viewers to view aliens, to view extraterrestrials as either women or dogs. That just blew me away.
Yeah, when you first got the report, you and I spent a little time speculating on where they took the wreckage, where this place might be.
And, of course, my first thought was that some of this stuff could have been Dulce, and I still think that actually one of those answers referred to the Dulce underground base. But, you know, I'm remembering pictures from Los Alamos in 1948, and to me, anyway, that looks to me like there's some resemblance to that, too. I would have to go and look at some old pictures again, but the ones that I remember seem to me that they would certainly work with the kind of descriptions that we talked about last night.
Mm-hmm.
Lynn suggested that maybe it was a university or some government installation somewhere here or somewhere else. Now, they did come into, they came to some very specific conclusions after looking at all of this information. And I can give you those. There was an overview. He says, I'll just read some of this to you because it says it much better than I could even ever paraphrase.
Okay, fine.
He says, analysis of the session information from these 11 viewers indicates that the tasking for this project was probably not exact enough. And he admitted that right up front. But he said, this is a possible scenario based on the information provided. It doesn't indicate that this is the only possible scenario, nor does it prove that this scenario is more accurate than any other. So he ends up with an overview. A, this is what they decided. There was a large object low above the ground, which then went to the ground. The object was extremely large and was designed for transportation. It was of silvery gray or black color. So this is what they get. This is what they're saying they got from the remote viewers. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And B, there were people observing the vehicle who were interested, curious, and happy to see it. There was a coming at you, and that's gonna hurt kind of attitude among those people, he said. He said there were one or more biologicals who were disabled or hurt, and someone was trying to help them, but could not do so because of an inability to understand. There were teams of people in helmets and protective clothing doing construction and deconstruction. And these teams appeared to work in shifts, waiting their turn. There was some kind of attempt at negotiation among the parties involved, but understanding was difficult. The negotiations may have ended in the unofficially observed execution of some of the participants. That was a tough one.
Janet, did Lynn go into detail about this execution of an ET? I mean, or maybe even more than one? I mean, what happened there? I mean, were we trying to put them out of their misery or something?
No, I'm looking through my other notes right now, and as I recall, see, I've got several sets of notes here. He said that apparently they could not. There was one woman, and when I read you last night, we talked about the woman who seemed to be kind of a policewoman, and that she was in charge of getting something done, and that somebody had actually fired into this room. And that apparently is what this was all about, that negotiations just fell apart and that the easiest solution for us was to execute this living being. And there were obviously several living beings.
Wow. Do you get the impression we killed all of the ETs?
You know, not really.
Okay.
I get the impression that there were several alive when this craft landed, from what he said and from what's in the report, and I get the impression that some of those beings that were still alive when the crash landed probably died, and that whatever kind of communication or negotiations or whatever was happening with this last living being, it ended in an execution. That's what I got from it.
You are convinced that Lynn Buchanan thinks Aztec, the 1948 UFO crash happened, right?
Absolutely, yes. He said absolutely he believed that. He said the valuation, based on all the information that came in, was that there was a craft and that it did indeed crash. He said the valuation ended up meaning, saying that there were one or more EBEs who were hurt. And that at least one of them was executed.
And as far as you are concerned, it's still an open question. I mean, because we don't really know where they took the EBEs or the wreckage after the crash.
Well, like I said, he didn't. He had his own kind of ideas. He said that based on the information they got back from, he came up with a conclusion that it was some kind of university setting, or possibly, or that it was some kind of government setting, that it had kind of a campus that went with it. And that's where I came up with Los Alamos. I have a note here that says, looks like Los Alamos to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and then I have a note underneath it that says, was Los Alamos like that in 1948? And I've been to Los Alamos a number of times and seen some old-timey pictures. And it seems to me that throughout World War II, the place grew, you just grew by leaps and bounds, and that it was pretty much a well-planned out little town and very neat and clean and with, you know, with not only bunkers, not bunkers, but, you know, bunkhouses for the enlisted people, but very comfortable homes and buildings for teaching and stuff like that for everybody else. I remember seeing black and white pictures that, when I heard this, immediately came to mind. He volunteered, he said they found Saddam Hussein. They found a whole lot, his crew. He said after 9/11, he knew immediately where he could find bin Laden. He offered to find bin Laden, because I asked him, I said, if you can find Saddam Hussein, if you can find all these other people, why haven't we found bin Laden yet? And he said, the government doesn't want us to find bin Laden. He said, I could have done that within 2 or 3 days after 9/11, but they didn't want me to do that. And everybody said, why? And somebody said, exactly at the same time he said it, he said, because they didn't want him because there would be no more reason for a war. And that was when I pressed him, and I said, who is they? And he waved his hand, and he said, the government. And I said, what part of the government? And he said, I don't know from what part of the government. I said, well, was it our elected government? Was it the president? He said, I don't. And he just kind of passed off and would not answer that question. So
okay.
I don't know if he felt it was classified and he'd already told us too much or what. But he was very specific about the fact that not only did the group that he worked with know where Saddam Hussein was, they have always known. See, I've been kind of in the my own personal feeling is that bin Laden probably has been dead for the last several years. From liver disease or whatever it is that makes
yeah.
him so sick. But he insists, he says he really believes bin Laden is still alive.
Huh.
Anyway, thanks very much, Janet, for covering this for us. We appreciate you.
Oh, you're welcome. Anytime.
Okay, we'll talk to you later.
Thanks a bunch.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye.
Janet Saylor will be there again this weekend, and she'll be giving another report for us next Monday night. Still have time to make your reservations and show up for that symposium, by the way. Simply go to aztecufo.com. By the way, Janet has quite a conference put together this year, the 2011 symposium, Paranormal Symposium, is moving to Taos. And it will be a different date. It will be October 25 through October 30. And it'll be at the Calchina Lodge there in Taos. Lots of the same great things that she's always had planned, plus some new events and new ways of doing things. And take a look at her website, and that's aspiefiles.org. And she has a lineup, and you can already make your reservations. Taos is a great place, especially that time of year. And we'll be talking to Janet about that in detail pretty soon. Always one of the great symposiums, the 2011 Paranormal Symposium, and that'll be at the Calchino Lodge, and that's in Taos, New Mexico, and that'll be March 25 through March 30. Let's get back to Aztec. Now, Lynn Buchanan will be there, and he'll be talking about what he's found out in the past year, researching more and tasking his remote viewers more on Aztec. And that's something really that I think you would be very interested in hearing. So if you can get out there, if you're in the Four Corners area, New Mexico, Colorado, please plan on attending. And if you can't make it, we'll have coverage here on the Jerry Pippin Show, of course. We talked to Lynn Buchanan about his career, and let's pick up this interview with Lynn, in which we were talking to him. Basically, he just finished explaining to me that the 11 remote viewers are not in this country. They're all over the world. Some are in Europe, some are other places, some in the United States. It was a good opportunity for me to talk to Lynn about how he got interested in remote viewing and how it works and what it really is all about. So listen, I think you'll find it interesting.
Other countries.
So how does this work? I mean, do they remote view all at the same time or how? I mean, what, explain
it. No, I just send out the tasking over email. And they do their sessions, and they send us the results. We compile the results and provide the answer and a report. We do that for companies, for corporations, for police departments, for archaeologists, and so forth.
You know, Lynn, I think our audience is always interested in the real story behind the guest. And yours is certainly an interesting story. You have a unique profession, for sure. Why don't you tell our audience, well, I guess, first of all, how you got started.
Well, I got started in the military. I was one of the military's controlled remote viewers, also the database manager, and wore several other hats in the military unit. Once I retired from the military, the controlled remote viewing unit and all that was still classified, and so I went to work for the Defense Intelligence Agency. And then in late 1995, they effectively declassified the fact that the military had a remote viewing unit, what we did and so forth. And so all of a sudden they found out that I was the trainer. The public found out that I had been the trainer for the unit. And so I started getting in all of these requests for training. And I, at the time, was traveling 2.5 to 3 hours into D.C. every day, working a 12-hour day, and then traveling 2.5 to 3 hours going home. And it dawned on me that I could do this, you know, do the training, which I love to do, and not commute. And so
I guess you moved out to New Mexico, huh?
Well, I moved out to New Mexico a couple of years later.
Mm-hmm.
But and I still teach here. But, you know, I started teaching the public remote viewing, started teaching it to police, to businessmen, and so on. The controlled remote viewing is different from what people are calling remote viewing.
Well, tell me the difference.
Basically, the term remote viewing came about when they declassified, the unit and the fact that the government had been using remote viewing. They didn't tell anybody what it was. And so there were reporters in the D.C. area that were traveling around, you know, driving around the D.C. area looking for palm reader signs on front lawns and things like this, and going in and asking Madame Zoltar what remote viewing was. Well, it very quickly became what everybody did, you know. And once they found out that it was scientifically accepted, because it is a scientific process, process. Then everybody started calling themselves remote viewers. And so these days, the term remote viewing is the new age term for psychic. And you can find palm remote viewers and crystal ball remote viewers and all that. Controlled remote viewing is a science that was developed in the laboratories out at Stanford Research Institute to do espionage work for the government. And so, I mean, you can already see the difference here.
Mm-hmm.
It is basically, well, I think the best way to describe it, you know how a lie detector can tell whether you're lying or telling the truth. A good polygrapher can also tell if you're guessing. And a really good, highly trained polygrapher, believe it or not, can tell if you're guessing correctly or guessing incorrectly, even though you don't know the answer. The reason is that somewhere in your subconscious mind, I guess it's a connection with a collective unconscious or something, but the subconscious mind seems to know the answer. And through training, much like a martial art, you can get a person to be so sensitive to their own inner brainwave workings that they can make a guess and basically tell whether they're right or not. And, you know, within limits of human error.
Okay, Lynn, let's get a little more specific here. I was in the Army, too. It's a big organization. So how did you get into remote viewing in the first place? And was this a mixed unit or just the Army or what?
Oh, no. It was, by the time I got into it, it was Army.
Okay.
And the way I got into it, I know a lot of people don't believe in PK, you know, psychokinesis, but
mm-hmm.
I've had, well, I was one of those poltergeist kids growing up, and
when you say poltergeist kid, you mean you saw ghosts?
Oh, no, things fly off of shelves and things
okay,
like
I
that.
Okay, I got it. A mentalist, you could make things move. I just think about it, and they jump off the table.
Yes, and, you know, poltergeist kids get a bad rap because most of the time the ones you hear about are the ones who are mentally unstable and all that. But the fact is that a lot of kids have these poltergeist experiences, psychokinetic experiences. It scares them and they quit and all that. Well, when they started happening to me, I got fascinated by them and started studying them and started figuring out how to make it work. So anyway...
So you could really make objects move off the table and things, jump up and down.
I was getting to where I could do that, yeah.
Wow.
I was showing off for a cute little redheaded girl one day.
We have something in common. I have a weakness for redheads, too.
I tell you, Charlie Brown's life and my life coincide a lot. But I was showing off, and she was duly impressed and went home and told her father, the Pentecostal minister. And the next day, he and three of his deacons met me on the way home from school, and he, you know, just asked me a question, and by the time I finished my answer, he and his deacons had me down on the sidewalk with their hands pressing my face down into the ground, screaming for the devil to come out of me and all this other stuff.
Isn't that illegal? I mean, you were a minor, a child abuse there.
Well, I tell you, it scared the life out of me. And, I mean, this had always just been something neat that was happening.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, it was my soul going to hell for doing any of
it. Lynn, where did you live when this happened? I'm just curious.
Oh, I was in Bell, California.
Okay.
Yeah, out in California.
Yeah, okay.
And so, anyway, I tried to suppress it and tried to suppress it. But one time in the military, I got just flaming angry and computers just started going out. I've always had this problem of, you know, a lot of people have problems of they get around computers and the computers start acting up and going crazy and all that. So it's not.
I didn't
uncommon.
Know that about people getting mad at computers and making the computers go crazy. That's interesting.
Oh yeah. And
so you worked with computers when you were in the Army.
That's right.
Got to tell me more about this, Lynn. I mean, you got upset while on duty at the computers and screwed them up.
It just started frying computers. Well, at the time, there was an officer there who was looking for people who could do things like this because the military wanted to set up a unit that would be able to fry enemy computers. And so this guy witnessed that, and so he told the commanding general of the Intelligence and Security Command, and the next time the commanding general was out in Germany where I was stationed, he came by and he talked to me, and he just told me, you're going to be in a unit. Well, and, you know, you're going to help us form a unit to do this. Well, he got me back to D.C., and Congress would not fund it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a remote viewing unit there in Washington, D.C. area, and I was in D.C. He had nothing to do with me, and so he stuck me into the remote viewing unit. And
at that time, did the Army call it a remote viewing unit or what?
Well, they called it Operation Center Lane at the time.
Okay.
And that turned into Operation Stargate. They put me in this unit. And when they first read me on to what they do, you know, what they did, I thought I was on candy camera or something.
You thought they were putting you on, huh?
Oh, yeah. I thought, this is crazy. The Army doesn't do this kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
But sure enough, they did. And
hold on, Lynn. We've got to take a break. This is interesting stuff. Lynn Buchanan's our guest. We're talking about remote viewing. I'm Jerry Pippin. Now, before we get back to the interview of Lynn Buchanan, I would like to take an opportunity here to talk to you just briefly about the Aztec Library and their organization, the Friends of the Aztec Library. Now, they have been doing wonderful, wonderful work. If you ever get a chance to Aztec and you take a look at that library, you'll know what I mean. And a lot of the funds to build that library came from the Aztec symposiums. Now, if you can't get to Aztec, and we have listeners all around the world, so a lot of people are far, far from the Four Corners area of New Mexico, but you can help the Friends of the Library very simply by sending them a tax-free donation. They would appreciate it, whether it's $10, $25, $100, $1,000, whatever, it'll go to good use. Or if you want to use PayPal, click on their link to their website, and you'll see the information on how you can donate. There's also a mailing address at their website. Just go over there and check it out, AztecUFO.com. That's AztecUFO, all one word, .com. I urge you to do it. Be a friend of the Aztec Library. Won't you? Welcome back. This is Jerry Pippin. We're talking with Lynn Buchanan, and we're talking about remote viewing. And at the break, Lynn was explaining what happened in the Army when they sent him to the unit that did remote viewing.
I tell you, I took to it like a duck to water, and it just became so natural.
Can you tell me your first controlled remote viewing experiment with the Army? Or is that classified?
It wasn't Terry Waite. It was one of the Iranian hostages.
Remember the year? What year that was?
I think it was around 79. It was around 84, I think.
Oh, okay.
84.
Okay.
But this was a political hostage over in the Middle East. And we were keeping track of him every day. And, of course, during this time, I was being trained myself in how to do this technology.
Okay, now, during this time in the Army, who was training you?
Ingo Swan.
I know him.
Researcher with SRI had developed this technique. He had taught the members of the unit. I was supposed to train with him, and yet the Congress cut the contract the week before I got there. And so I was training from the other members of the unit who had trained with Ingo.
Mm-hmm.
I have since become friends with Ingo, and just a totally fascinating, talented person. But I was trained by the members of the unit. And like I say, it just came so natural to me, and I love it.
And I still don't understand it exactly. When you remote view something, control remote viewing, is it like watching a movie, or do you feel things, or is it a dream, or what?
It starts out kind of like a dream state. And you do it wide awake. There's no trance. There's no altered state or anything else.
So
and
maybe daydream would be better than dream. But I mean, it's almost like you're there.
I wanted to sit there and ask you a question about what's around you, and you can look over, or you can listen, or you can smell, or, you know, sniff the air.
Well, as I said, it's almost like you're there.
It is almost like you're there, yeah.
Now, the other thing, are you saying time does not exist? You can go back, like to 1948, to the Aztec crash, or forward, or whatever?
In controlled remote viewing, there is no difference structurally between, say, move forward 5 feet, or move forward 5 years, or move back, you know, move back 1 mile, you can say move back 10 years.
It was Lynn Buchanan, and he'll be making his presentation in Aztec on Saturday. It's going to be interesting. Can't wait to hear the report. Wish I could make it out there. If you're in the area, I hope you can. In the Four Corners area, New Mexico, Colorado, at Aztec. It's only $25, and you can go over to their website and get the information and make a reservation. And Friday night, they have a great dinner, and Norio Hayakawa will be there playing his one-man band. Quite a talented guy, as well as a great researcher. Just go to AztecUFO.com and check out the details. I thought we'd go ahead and finish the program out on remote viewing. This is a classic interview. Paula Harris joined me, well-known researcher and journalist, internationally known and acclaimed, quite an ethical lady as well. And she's worked with us off and on over the years. And she joined us in Laughlin, Nevada.
Russell,
and we
Targ
talked to Russell Targ
icon
when it comes to remote viewing. And let's just go ahead and play the interview. And you'll find out some very interesting things about remote viewing. Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and we're broadcasting from Laughlin, Nevada, overlooking the beautiful Colorado River at the Aquarius Resort. And, of course, it's the UFO Congress, and it's an incredible conference. Lots of international guests, lots of movers and shakers in the business, always unusual people. And we have a great person here with us that works with us occasionally, Paula Harris. How are you?
Pretty good. Thank you for having me.
Where did you all get together, in Stanford?
We were at Stanford Research Institute. Hal Puthoff and I started a program to investigate psychic abilities. We had both been laser physicists. Hal was at Stanford University, and I was at Sylvania. I was building lasers, and Hal was investigating lasers for his PhD. And we met at a conference where he was lecturing on Soviet research in extrasensory perception, which is a subject that I had been lecturing as well. And we got together and thought that since we lived near one another in Palo Alto, California, that maybe we could interest Stanford Research Institute in actually starting a program. But, of course, money is necessary for that. So in the course of looking for government support, we went to the CIA, and we went to NASA, and both of them agreed to support our program.
Did you? There was a story, Russell, that you told once that Wernher von Braun had a psychic grandmother, and that's how he got the money to do a lot of the research. It was a joke you were telling, but Wernher von Braun was involved in this too, right?
Well, in my experience trying to get money for ESP research, what I discovered is that everybody has a psychic grandmother. In this particular case, I had been invited to give a lecture at a conference on speculative technology on St. Simon's Island off the coast of Georgia. A NASA administrator, George Pesdertz, had invited me to lecture on the work I was doing privately, teaching people to get in touch with the part of themselves that's psychic. I had built an ESP teaching machine, and Pesdertz from NASA invited me to this quite high-level conference off on St. Simon's Island. And after I gave my lecture, I then walked out onto the pier with Wernher von Braun and the administrator of NASA, Jim Fletcher, and Arthur C. Clarke, and Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut.
That's an impressive group of people, Jerry.
That's quite a walk.
I know.
So what I knew is that if I behaved myself and did things properly, these are the men who could provide the financial support to get me out of laser research and eventually fund a program in extrasensory perception. And I told them that I had built this four-choice electronic trainer that allowed people to choose which of four buttons to select, indicating which of four lights they thought was going to come on, and people can learn to achieve a relationship. What I proposed to von Braun is that astronauts who would work with this machine could achieve a rapport with the electronic random number generator and learn to get in touch with the part of themselves that's psychic, as it were, so they could achieve a rapport with their spacecraft, so that the American astronauts could learn to become psychic and in tune with their spacecraft. I learned a couple of years later that the Soviets were already doing that particular thing. I had lunch with cosmonaut Sevastyanov, who is a Soviet cosmonaut, and he told us that when in orbit, he and his fellow cosmonauts dropped into a kind of telepathic rapport with one another, and they could sense when things are going wrong with the spacecraft that they're riding on. So it's as though being out of the Earth atmosphere and away from the electromagnetic chatter on the Earth, they're able to become more psychic and more in tune with their own psychic selves. So they're psychic with each other and with the spacecraft.
Did you find that held true in later years with other people traveling into space, other experiences?
I did not hear that from other space travelers, although Edgar Mitchell, as you know, had an epiphany of a psychic kind, a transformational experience, when he was returning from the moon to Earth. And he also did ESP card-guessing experiments at that time, where he found that people on Earth were significantly able to correctly guess the cards that he had with him in his Apollo spacecraft. So that there is a connection between psychic ability and being outside the Earth's atmosphere and away from the chatter, the electromagnetic chatter. For example, at our laboratory at Stanford, we found that people behave more psychically and actually are able to improve their remote viewing by being inside of an electromagnetic screen. So we did most of our work for the government and for research inside of a shielded enclosure, a so-called Faraday cage. And what we find is that over the years, there is a literature starting with Andrea Puharic, who's a physician and ESP researcher in the 50s, what he found is that people do better and feel more psychic when they're inside of a Faraday cage. So we did all of our work that way. The work we were doing at Stanford was to investigate an ability that we call remote viewing. It was named remote viewing by Ingo Swann, and this is an ability that we all have to look into the distance, look into the future, and describe and experience things that are blocked from our ordinary perception. And we did that very significantly, so much so that our program was supported by the Central Intelligence Agency, Defense Intelligence Agency, Army Intelligence, NASA, and so forth. We're supported for 23 years at the tune of about $25 million to provide information to the intelligence community about various overseas activities. As we looked in at Chinese atomic bomb tests, Soviet weapons factories, we helped with the find American General Dozier, who was kidnapped in Verona and taken to Padua, and the great psychic Joe McMonagle was able to identify where in this new city he had actually been kidnapped. And we found a downed Soviet airplane. We did a number of applications over that period, which is how we kept ourselves funded for the 23-year time period.
Can anyone become a remote viewer, or is it a certain type of... do you have to have a lot of intelligence already, or does that have anything to do
with it? Well, intelligence always helps no matter what you're trying to do.
I imagine you're but, right.
But remote viewing is not a kind of IQ test. Everybody has some amount of psychic abilities. So the thing that brought me to this UFO conference is to show that psychic ability is very widely distributed, and in a typical three-hour lecture demonstration, most of the people in the audience will either do something psychic or see something psychic. The connection between ESP and UFOs was really first described by Jacques Vallée, the prolific writer on UFO topics for three decades, where Jacques says that the observations of UFOs are very important both from a sociological and a scientific point, but in his opinion, many, many of the UFO sightings are neither objects nor flying. As UFOs are generally unidentified flying objects, but he thinks that there's a large mental concomitant to the UFO experience. For example, oftentimes people are looking at UFOs in the sky and they disappear rather than flying away. Or they're looking at a UFO in the sky and of the four people gathered, two can see it and two cannot. So there's often a surprising psychic or psychological part to the UFO experience.
So is it like a psychic moment when the two people can see it and the other people can't? It's like their awareness goes into either another dimension or another level that they can see it?
It certainly seems like that. That is, there's a nuts and bolts component as well. That is, UFOs are tracked by radar, and when they land in the grass, they make an impression in the grass, and they can be seen and photographed, so they certainly have a physical aspect. They also have this peculiar non-physical aspect, which makes them seem part real, or let's say part material, part psychic or psychological. We really don't know what UFOs are, of course, but Jim Dolan, who wrote a wonderful book, in my view, the most comprehensive...
Richard Dolan.
Thank you very much. Richard Dolan wrote a very comprehensive book called UFOs and the National Security State. And in that, he says, as a historian, as a professional historian, what Dolan says is that I only know two things for sure about UFOs after writing this 500-page book. One of the things that he knows for sure is that something like UFOs really exist. And the other thing he knows for sure is that the government is lying about them.
You know, you've been in the government, at least funded by them. do you think anyone in the government knows a little bit more and we're not speaking about UFOs, or really are we all in the dark?
Well, I'm sure that some people in the government know more about them. That is, in the so-called MJ-12 documents that Ryan Wood and his father, Bob Wood, just released in book form, and now that they knew DVD called The Secret, discussing the MJ-12 documents, it's very clear that there have been a history of government interest in UFOs extending back to the 1940s.
You know where I'm going, so have you tried remote viewing to contact extraterrestrials on UFOs?
Well, many of the people involved in the program at SRI, Ingo Swann and Pat Price, who are two of our very most successful remote viewers, were also very involved and experiencers in the UFO arena. Now, as a scientist, it's not very rewarding to do. Remote viewing of a flying saucer. For example, if I quieted my mind, I say, there's one now, I can travel inside, I see this, that, and the other, hear the aliens, hear what the beings look like, and I write that down, but that's just my story. There's no way to validate that. As a researcher, I like to do remote viewing of objects or situations that eventually give us some feedback. For example, the most important thing that we learned about psychic abilities from our 25 years at SRI is that psychic abilities, and remote viewing in particular, is a non-local ability. That is to say, it's independent of space and independent of time, and we're quite confident of that. Because we've done experiments that show very clearly that it's no harder to look across the planet from San Francisco to China or from San Francisco to Moscow than it is to look across the street. That is, increasing the distance a thousandfold doesn't decrease the accuracy or the reliability at all.
One thing I'm kind of confused about is, can you see the future in remote viewing, or is it always the present?
Not only can we see the future, we have seen the future. We've done many precognitive experiments. In fact, early in the program, the CIA came to us and had a task for Ingo Swann where the CIA agent said to Ingo, something's going to happen in China 4 days from now. Could you describe that? And he gave Ingo the geographical coordinates, latitude and longitude. He said, now I want you to cast your mind ahead 4 days from Monday to Thursday, and what's going to happen at these coordinates next Thursday? And Ingo said, well, this is very interesting. This is very beautiful. Get me some colored pencils. And when I gave him colored pencils, he drew a succession of hemispherical colored pyrotechnic displays. It looked like a fireworks demonstration that you'd see on the 4th of July. And he said, what I see is a beautiful pyrotechnic display in many colors, and there are a bunch of trucks off in the background. And that information was all the CIA needed to confirm that the Chinese were indeed going to carry out an atomic bomb test 4 days in the future, and in fact it would fail. Because what Ingo saw is the telltale, reliable signature of burning uranium that does not explode, but just burns in a kind of pyrophoric bonfire, sending streamers up into the air like a 4th of July display, which is what you get when you burn uranium that fails to explode. So Ingo was able to look 4 days in the future, correctly identify that an atomic bomb test is what was going to occur at that location, and then he could cast his mind ahead into that time frame and see that they would do the test and that it would fail.
There's one danger to remote viewing, though, you mentioned in your lecture yesterday, Russell, and that is that if people really get into it and people are really good at remote viewing, people are really good with their ESP, they can tell when someone is lying.
Oh, that's very true. When I was once lecturing in the Soviet Union about these kind of experiments after I had left the SRI program. The SRI program was classified secret, so I couldn't talk to anybody while I was part of the program. But once I was in the Soviet Union lecturing to the Academy of Sciences, one of the concerned physicists stood up and said, if what you say is true, doesn't it mean that nothing is secret anymore? And I had to confirm, indeed, that there are no secrets, because the remote viewer is able to quiet his mind and describe what is the case. Basically, anytime you have a question that actually has an answer, the remote viewer can give the answer. Probably the most famous remote viewing that we did was not part of the SRI program, but after I left the program, I created a company called Delphi Associates, and one of our entertaining projects was to systematically forecast changes in the silver commodity market. What we wanted to find out is whether we could make money using ESP.
And
well,
you guys made money. You made money.
Right. The short answer is we were successful. The reason this was an interesting program is that it would be nice if you could just quiet your mind and look up at the big board at the commodity exchange and read whether silver has gone up or down at the end of the week. But you're not able to read psychically. At least most of us are not. So we had to. The psychic functioning is a non-analytical ability. That is, naming and guessing and grasping and reading.
Do you actually see a vision in your mind, or is it more of just a feeling?
It's seeing a vision in your mind.
Didn't you use knives and forks or something like that, a fork and spoon, to see positive and negative?
Yes, we used associative remote viewing, which is a kind of remote viewing that Stephen Schwartz taught us. Schwartz was the proprietor of the Mobius Society at the time, and he recognized that you can't read numbers psychically. But his scheme from his Navy work as a cryptographer is that you can make an association between the changes in the silver market that you're interested in and little objects that are quite easy to describe. For example, if I put a teddy bear in a box and bring it to you and say, tell me what's in my box, an experienced remote viewer will have no problem describing, I see something soft and brown and it looks like an animal, as compared with a fork, which would be something shiny and metallic and pointy. So in the remote viewing we did, we made use of this associative remote viewing, where each week the broker in San Francisco would choose four objects. For example, he might choose a light bulb and a pancake and a wine bottle and a carnation. And he might decide the carnation is represents the market going up a lot. The wine bottle might represent going up a little. The fork might be going down a little, and the pancake might represent going down a lot. Now, I, of course, as the interviewer in this two-person game, would not know anything about the objects. So I would turn to my psychic that I'm working with, say Paula, for example, who's sitting right here, and I say, here we are on Monday. We want you to describe, please, what I'm going to put in your hand next Friday. I don't know what it could be. It could be any kind of thing. But I'd just like you to cast your mind ahead and describe what you're experiencing with regard to what I will put in your hand at 4 o'clock next Friday.
Carnation.
And Paula might say, I feel something that's kind of round and floppy, and it has a bad smell. This rather disgusting, floppy, round, soft, squishy. I don't like this thing. I don't know what it is. That's what I get. So I would then call up the broker and say, broker, I got this very odd description from Paul about this round, floppy object with a funny smell. Do you have anything like that? He said, well, yes, that's my object that corresponds to down a lot. It's a pancake left over from my breakfast. So based on Paula's excellent description of the leftover pancake, we would sell silver on Monday with the anticipation that it would go down during the week and we could buy it back at a lower price at a later time. It's called short selling. We did that activity on 9 consecutive weeks, of course, always with different object sets, and we were successful every time in this 1-in-4 game. 100% successful. We made $120,000. Doing remote viewing. So the answer to people who say God won't let you use your psychic ability to make money, that's simply not correct.
I think, Jerry, we should think about this with Russell.
Right, he's my new partner.
He's my new partner, too. We'll start a company.
And we did that with a famous psychic who was very experienced doing that, and that was 1982, a long time ago. And
was
then
that McMonagle?
No, it was somebody different.
Oh, somebody different, okay.
Then in 1995, I wrote a book with Jane Catra, who's a spiritual healer. We wrote a book called Miracles of Mind. And the publisher said, if you folks are describing how to do remote viewing, you ought to demonstrate that you can do it. Can you show that you two people actually know what you're talking about? So Jane and I set up a silver forecasting experiment with two other friends of ours who are professional mathematicians. They chose the targets, and they set up the whole transaction. And in a period of a dozen weeks, Jane and I each week would make a forecast for the silver market, and we were correct 11 out of 12 times.
Still good.
Yeah. We were just forecasting, is it going up or is it going down? So we had an easier task. But doing anything correctly 11 out of 12 times is pretty hard to do.
I'm impressed. I don't know why he's here. He ought to be back at the silver market.
But what you might want to talk about, because we've looked at the very mundane applications of remote viewing, is the healing part. Because with Jane Catra, you've written a book called Miracles of Mind, but it dealt with healing. This same kind of ability of projecting what we have as these kind of powers or senses can also help us in our everyday life and healing.
Right? Now, this was understood a long time ago. Patanjali, who's a great Hindu writer 100 years before Christ, wrote in his sutras, the sutras of Patanjali, he wrote that once you clear your mind and have an opportunity to experience this expanded awareness, you can see into the distance, see into the future, heal the sick, and diagnose illnesses. And we have been able to demonstrate all of those things. Remote viewing is an opportunity to inflow information from the distance or from the future. And one additional kind of information that you can inflow is information about the medical and mental state of a distant person, and that's called intuitive diagnosis. Two of the famous practitioners are Judith Orloff in Los Angeles, who's wrote a very interesting book called Second Sight, and Mona Lisa Schultz in Boston.
And Edgar Casey in Newport Beach, but that was a long time
ago. Mona Lisa Schultz's book is Awakening Intuition, and perhaps the most famous medical intuitive is the woman who worked with Norm Shealy, who we'll think of her. Carolyn Meese has written many books about her experiences with medical intuition.
When we talk about these things, are you saying that the person doesn't even have to be in a room, that you can still diagnose their health problems?
That's right.
Across the planet someplace?
Yeah, you know, it's better if they're not in the room, because doctors learn to do snap diagnoses where they look at the person who walks in the room and can tell in a flash that's a gallbladder that just walked in, or that person has diabetes. I had a housemate who had learned to do intuitive diagnosis at the Berkeley Psychic Institute, and she thought that I should be able to do that because of my experience with remote viewing. So the first thing that I did in following her instructions, was to purchase the 36 hours of anatomy and physiology tape from the teaching company so that I would have an idea analytically of what I was looking at. And then I asked my teacher, Catherine, to bring me cards in individual envelopes shuffled up so that when she would hand me a card carrying the name of a distant person, she wouldn't know who it was. Because otherwise, if she just hands me a card for her Aunt Tilly, then I can become very skillful at reading Catherine's mind with regard to her opinions about Aunt Tilly, and that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to learn to contact the distant person directly. So she would give me an envelope containing a card of a distant person, and then I would describe my mental impressions regarding the health of that person.
Wow.
And that turned out to be much easier than ordinary remote viewing. I was very successful.
More difficult.
Even as a straight-up physicist, that turned out to be quite easy to do. In one of my very first trials, I just held the envelope in my hand and mentally visualized the body of the person from top to bottom, and I saw their organs in this nice pale blue fashion as I was accustomed to in the video and in the DVDs I was looking at. And then when I got down to their pancreas, which I recognized, I saw it had this sort of ugly orange color, and I said, I see this really distorted, ghastly-looking pancreas. This person looks to me like a diabetic, and that was the right answer. And that was my very first intuitive diagnosis. It was perfectly accurate and took about as long to do as it took to describe.
We'll be right back with Russell Targ, the guru of modern-day remote viewing, and Paula Harris, one of the great reporters in the world today. Tales of High Strangeness, Jerry Pippin's Parazone. Check out our stories of the horrific, the interesting, the spiritual on the paranormal pages of jerrypippin.com. Yeah, this is Jerry Pippin along with Paula Harris, and Russell Targ is our guest. He is a physicist and author who was a pioneer in the development of the laser and co-founder at the Stanford Research Institute's investigation into psychic abilities back in the 1970s and 1980s. Recently, Mr. Targ authored several books. The most recent one is Limitless Minds, A Guide to Remote Viewing and Transformation of Consciousness. He's co-author of Mind Reach, Scientists Look at Psychic Abilities, The Mind Race, Understanding and Using Psychic Abilities, Miracles of Mind, Remote Viewing and Spiritual Healing, and The Heart of the Mind, How to Experience God Without
Belief. Well, I spent a lot of time sitting in the dark. I spent a decade sitting with my eyes shut, helping people. Yes.
Situation we need
what,
to look
what
at.
What about that. Ethics in this, Russell?
Well, I think
how do you feel about it personally?
Well, I don't think that psychic abilities are sacred, if that's what you're asking. I think that psychic abilities are just abilities. And as a scientist, my interest in psychic abilities and remote viewing is what they clearly show is that we profoundly misunderstand the nature of the space and time in which we live. We live in a world where your consciousness is in intimate contact with places and times that are separated from the location of your physical body. So what it shows is that your consciousness is profoundly non-local and your awareness fills all of space and time. So it shows that whereas in modern physics we talk about non-locality as a kind of entanglement between elementary particles. The idea of entanglement has come into common usage now. But remote viewing is not really the entanglement between this person and that person. It's more the fact that we live in a world where the geometry of space and time is inherently non-local. That is, it's the geometry of space and time that allows our awareness to describe things that are physically distant because in the domain of consciousness, there is no distance. That is to say, we live in a physical plane. That is, there's floorboards under our feet and physical separation in feet between where we're sitting. But on the conscious plane, there is no separation at all. Once you get off of the physical plane with your consciousness, then you have the opportunity to experience things that are physically distant from where you're sitting, but in conscious, in the, if you go and make use of the non-local connections, there's no separation at all. And I should say this is the old idea. This is not modern physics. In the Buddhist teachings, every page of the Buddhist writings, such as the Prajnaparamita, to the compendium of Buddha's writings, you find that separation is an illusion, and the illusion of separation is something described throughout all the writing. That's been understood for 2,500 years.
I think Russell is saying that it's like hearing or seeing or tasting. It's just a sixth sense. It's nothing strange. We all have it. And I guess the other part of that is if we all have it, then maybe you couldn't have a stock market because we would all know. So it gets really complicated because if we all knew and we all could read each other's minds, then people wouldn't be lying, so we wouldn't have all kinds of situations we have today. We'd be using our consciousness. We wouldn't be using our very limited senses.
You know, Paula, Russell, you mentioned this location thing. I immediately thought about interplanetary operations. I hear stories about remote viewing on Mars. You know anything about that?
Yes, Ingo Swann did remote viewing early on, describing rings around the pattern of around the planet Jupiter, whereas everyone knows about the rings of Saturn. But as the Pioneer spacecraft was being launched, Ingo volunteered to take a look at Jupiter as well, and he said that Jupiter not only has rings, but the Pioneer spacecraft will show those rings. And I wanted to mention that remote viewing is a widely distributed ability. That in the workshop, we had 500 people here. I would say everyone at the workshop either did something psychic or saw something psychic. And the book that I published 2 years ago called Limitless Mind shows the protocols we used at SRI so that a person wanted to begin to get in touch with their psychic abilities, they could just look at the experimental portion of Limitless Mind, find a friend to do experiments with, and are very likely able to demonstrate their own psychic abilities.
But using it is another thing. It takes a responsibility. I mean, as far as you make your life easier, you also said it's like knowing where the keys to the car are or where there's this parking spot. But it's even more than that for a lot of people.
That's right. My daughter used to, when my daughter was a college student, she would call me up and say, I've lost my term paper. Do you see a purple folder? And I would close my eyes and say, have you tried looking behind the piano? And she'd roll out the piano and find her folder. So it's definitely an ability to find lost objects.
Did this ability, was it developed over the years, or did you have an originally as a child?
Well, I found psychic abilities creeping into my life as a teenager when I would do stage magic. That is every
interesting little sideline to his
life. He was a magician.
Yeah,
can you imagine the magician?
See, every magician who does mental magic has the experience of suddenly knowing more about the person you're tricking than is revealed to you by the trick that you just did. So that's something. Even magicians who hate ESP will agree that sometimes they get some additional information. I should say, if you want more information from me, I have a website which will lead to more information and also allow you to contact me. My website is www.espresearch.com, and I generally answer my email.
Paula Harris is with me, and I'm Jerry Pippin. We're talking with Russell Targ, and I guess you have to have a quiet place to do this remote viewing, Russell. We're in a casino. Maybe when we come back, we'll talk about casinos and remote viewing, hunches, psychic hunches. That kind of interests me. I think it will the listeners, too. Don't go away. But first, I just want to take a moment to remind you that you can go to UFOTV.com and get UFOT sticker and iron-on fun kit for free. You can download it, and all of this stuff is for free. It's now available at www.ufotv.com. UFOTV Area 51 Groom Lake Yacht Club stickers. Iron-on Fun Kit. These are stickers with really great artwork. Really rivals anything that Disney has put out. Well, in fact, I suspect that Tim Crawford's recent announcement about using some of the former Disney principles in creating the first worldwide video internet TV network has really come into play here. UFOTV has a great ebook section, by the way, as well. A free ebook is available each month. So take your time and go to UFOTV.com for the best in UFO and conspiracy documentary films. No one has a better selection, trust me. Great informational and entertainment videos worldwide and at prices you can afford. Streams for as low as $1.99. Check it out. Just go to UFOTV.com and enjoy, enjoy, enjoy. That's UFOTV.com. Russell Targ, let's get to the casino question. I don't imagine that's a good place for remote viewing, but maybe it's been tried.
Right, the casino is very unconducive to quieting your mind. They have constant noise and jingling sounds and music and every other kind of noise piped in addition to the machines, so as to keep you both on edge and hypnotized indefinitely, not psychic. That is, a experienced player can walk around a casino and be intuitive about which machine is going to pay off and then put his money in that machine. But the more noise there is in the environment, the more difficult that is to do.
Have you ever tried that, like in playing 21?
Yeah, I've done both of those things. After I left Lockheed was my last industrial job, and I then helped create a ESP program at a little company called Interval Research, started by Paul Allen, who is one of the Microsoft billionaires. And I was trying to interest the management in the reality of psychic functioning at a conference of the Society for Scientific Exploration. And I had given a little talk about the fact that you could determine which machines are going to pay off. And after my talk, they said, well, if you can do that, I'd like to see it. And I walked around in one circuit. I pulled two jackpots and made $800 in the old days when the dollars come tinkling out of the machine. And based on that $800 win, we started a program at Interval that ran for several years.
And this picture ended up on the security wall.
No, they kicked him out of the casinos, I think.
Then my daughter got kicked out of a casino. My daughter, Elizabeth Targ, who is a psychiatrist, working together with Hella Hammett, who is one of our great psychic superstars at SRI, very lovely, personable woman, cultivated woman, together with James Spottiswood, who's a mathematician. The three of them went to a Las Vegas casino for the purpose of making a lot of money using this associative remote viewing with roulette. And they were betting high, low, and middle. That is to say, they'd use associative remote viewing, which is the game with three objects, where they would try and determine whether the ball would stop between 1 and 12, 13 to 24, 25 to 36, which is has a 3-to-1 payoff. Of course, the house wins if you get 0 or double 0, so it's not a fair game, but it's almost a fair game. And if you put down $1,000 and win, they give you $3,000. So, well, I was not part of this. My daughter was the ringleader, the second generation. So you had three quite psychic people, Elizabeth, Hella, and James Spottiswood. They would sit up in their hotel room where it's nice and quiet, and one of these three psychic explorers would quiet her mind and say, I see something that looks like a paperclip. And then James would look and see which of the three objects was most like a paperclip, and he would decide that that's the object that corresponded to the middle group between 13 and 25. The three of them would then go downstairs, wait for the exact hour, exactly 9 o'clock or exactly 8 o'clock. They'd put their $1,000 down on the middle ramp. The roulette has high, low, and middle along the side of the table. They'd put their $1,000 in chips down. They'd spin the wheel, win, collect their $3,000, and go back to the room. At the end of the evening, they had made $15,000 from four spins of the wheel, and the pit boss could see that these three cheerful young people looked nothing like the usual customers bumbling around the table. So after they had swept up their $15,000 for the fourth spin, they say, okay, kids, it's time to leave the casino right now. And they were escorted out by the men in black. But there was a perfectly successful trip in using this associative remote viewing to win at the roulette table.
Russell, I know you got to go here in just a second, and Paula has a meeting. But that was great. I love that story about the roulette. We'll be back to wrap this up with Russell Targ. What a phenomenal guy, and what a great interview. What a great show. We'll be right back. Speaking of great shows, let's talk about UFOTV.com. I'll take time out to let you know that this program is sponsored by UFOTV.com, the definitive source for UFO media on the Internet. Now featuring broadband streaming for as low as $1.99 and worldwide downloads of your favorite films. Downloads $9.95. Free UPS ground shipping, too, by the way. If you order before noon Pacific, it'll be shipped the same day. We're talking free of charge. UFO TV has the largest selection of UFO DVDs in the universe. Remember, they have a live person standing by to answer your questions about UFO TV anytime. Feel free to call the number. It's right there on the website. I hope you do take time out to check out the best in UFO media anywhere simply by going to www.ufotv.com. Russell Targ is our guest, and it's been a great show here, Russell, talking about remote viewing and psychic healing and gambling. you have any books out? Probably working on a new book now.
Well, I'm always writing another book. I've just finished writing a book called Do You See What I See? Which is the memoirs of a blind biker.
He is a motorcycle person, by the way. He did ride motorcycles up until recently.
I started to say, I have a vision impairment. I wouldn't dare get on a motorcycle.
I've been legally blind since childhood, so I have a lot of experience.
Oh, so you're used to it.
I have a lot of experience running.
I've only got 5 years.
You have a lot of. I have a lot of experience running around with 20/200 vision, but I was able to convince the Department of Motor Vehicles to let me have a tiny engine on my bike with a letter from a optometrist who gave me a vacuous letter saying that my vision had not deteriorated and I should be allowed to ride anything I can do safely. And with that silly letter, they let me start out with a 50cc French engine rubbing against the tire. But at the end of 35 years, I had a freeway legal 250cc Honda Nighthawk, which I rode.
No.
I wrote that.
I trust him. I would have ridden on the back. He's psychic. He's a psychic motorcycle driver.
So the new book is called Do You See What I See? Memoirs of a Blind Biker, which describes, at least in part, how I managed to ride my motorcycle for 35 years through the byways, potholes, and highways of the San Francisco Bay Area. And I talk about the start of the remote viewing program, and the fact that we need to understand psychic functioning as a way of understanding who we are as people with the potential for this great spacious realization, so we can begin to quiet our minds and experience the flow of loving awareness, which is our inherent nature.
The website again for you?
My website is www.espresearch.com.
We're so honored to have had you, Russell. Thank you so much for sharing.
I'm always very happy to chat with you.
It was a great pleasure meeting you for the first time. And Paula, it's always interesting having you with here. You always come up with some interesting people.
Well, I love to do the show with you, Jerry. Thank you very much.